Good evening, everybody. Shalom Aleichem, Gemar Chasima Tova. Welcome back, and thank you so much for joining me for this final shiur in the series, which we entitled Be Prepared. And it's hard to believe because we really started close to the beginning of the month of Elul, and now here we are almost 40 days later at the top of the mountain. And Bezras Hashem, tomorrow night we'll be literally here in this very place on the holy day of Yom Kippurim. And it's an inspiration that you're here, even in these final hours, especially at this time, to really try to again, focus our energies, our thoughts, and being able to be prepared, because it's not too late to prepare adequately for this special day. The topic I wanted to talk about tonight is one which is, on the one hand, unique to Yom Kippur, and really highlights a very, very interesting, a very fascinating, and really a very important facet of the day. At the same time, I think the messages that we will try to speak about tonight are messages that really can and should influence and impact and really inspire us throughout the year. So while there is only one day of Yom Kippurim, and some of the aspects of this particular feature, which we'll talk about in a moment, are unique to the day, I think that the messages are really messages that we should really try to think about how we can apply to every day of our life, and you know, I'll try to talk that through in greater depth with you. So we're going to segue our way into this discussion by way of a very interesting halacha. A halacha which has several hints and then some actual explicit descriptions, which are found particularly in the Seder Avoda, part of the Musaf on Yom Kippurim that we are going to recite. But that is that on Yom Kippur, as we know, the Kohen Gadol would make several visits to the Kodesh Kodashim, which of course is unique because it is only the Kohen Gadol on this day and this day only who is permitted to enter this very sacred place. The Torah, in fact, in Parshas Achrimos, in source number one, introduces the entire concept of Bias Kodesh Kodashim by first saying the Al Yavo B'chol Eisal HaKodesh, that in general a Kohen is not permitted to go ahead whenever he wants into the Heichal, and certainly beyond into the Kodesh Kodashim. It can only be done at specific times. The Kodesh Kodashim, as I mentioned already, only Bezos Yavo Aron El HaKodesh, only on the day of Yom Kippurim, at specific moments, with a specific job that he is to essentially carry out at that time. And other than that, he does not go into the Kodesh Kodashim. The Torah emphasizes and highlights in source number two, Uchal Adam, Lo Yia Ba'olam Oed B'vo'o L'chapeh B'Kodesh Atzei So. That when the Kohen Gadol goes into the Kodesh Kodashim, he is to be there by himself. That no one else is to escort him. Nobody should be there with him. There are other points throughout the day where there can be other people who are attending to and supporting and assisting the Kohen Gadol in various capacities. However, at the time that the Kohen Gadol goes into the Kodesh Kodashim, he is all by himself. And nobody else may be there. And the Lashon of the Rambam, very interesting Lashon, in source number 5, B'shas HaKetoras HaKetoras B'Kodesh Kodashim, at the time that the Kohen Gadol brings, offers the Ketoras in the Kodesh Kodashim, Kol Ha'om Porshim in a Heichal Bilvad. Everybody is going to remove themselves from this entire area. Which is a funny Lashon, because you would think that the Rama would just emphasize the fact that the Kohen Gadol is to go there and nobody else is to go there. The whole idea of Prisha prompts several of the Achronim, including over here, find in source number 6, of Soloveitchik quoting in the name of his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the Ein Isser B'yas Mikdash Ala Gavra Likonis Lehechu B'shas Kapara. It's not that there's a prohibition for each and every individual other than Kohen Gadol to enter the Kodesh Kodashim, El Hudin B'seder V'tzuras Kapara B'Kodesh Shedin Elios K'she'en Adam O'am Oloi. Rather, the way, in this very, you know, sort of typical, brisker terminology, way this is explained, it's a din in the Kapara in the Kodesh, namely, that the Kapara takes place only when the Kohen Gadol is there by himself. So it's not that there's an Isser for each and every person to enter the Kodesh Kodashim. The Kapara in the Kodesh Kodashim can only occur if and when the Kohen Gadol is by himself, which is why the Rambam emphasizes this idea of Prisha, of separation, that anybody else must leave or else the Kohen Gadol is not going to be able to accomplish what he needs to. and just to appreciate that conceptually, we could have imagined, we could have considered the possibility that the kapara, the Kohen Gadol, is going to be effective whether or not there are other people in the Kodesh Kodashim. It's just that the Torah happens to prohibit other people from entering. And the Rambam is explaining, no, that's not what's going on over here. The avoda in the Kodesh Kodashim is such that the Kohen Gadol must be by himself. And if anybody else is there, so that is going to interfere, that is going to obstruct the process of kapara. So with that sort of very brief and very important sort of technical introduction, so now let's think about this for a moment. Because from where we stand, in terms of our own frame of reference and what we are used to seeing, you know, in the world in which we live today, and I don't necessarily mean this in a critical way whatsoever, when there's a big event that's happening, so there's usually a lot of press beforehand, and we make every effort to promote this event and to make sure that as many people can either participate, or the way we would do today, we would share it and broadcast it so people could participate virtually, that there's just going to be, you know, a desire to have as many people participate in this event as possible. So we can even, we don't have to talk about secular events. Several months from now, there's going to be the great Siyum HaShas, which occurs once every 7.5 years, a great moment. The last event, which happened almost 7.5 years ago, MetLife Stadium had, I believe, about 92,000 participants. Obviously, there's a seating capacity, so the event's happening again in the same location, so there are going to be twice the number of people. But every effort is being made to see to it that there can be as many people participating actually or virtually. And, of course, because this is such a great, important, and seminal moment. On Yom Kippur, lahavdil, but the Avodah on Yom Kippurim was also a great, extraordinary moment. It didn't take place once every 7 years, it happens once a year. But you have over here a convergence of many, many different high levels of Kedusha. You know, if you think about it, the Kohen Gadol is the holiest Jew. You know, you have different types of Jews, Yisraelim, Levim, Kohanim, the Kohen Gadol, who is HaKohen HaGadol Miachav, as the Torah describes him. He is the elite among the Kohanim, coming on the holiest day of the year. You know, we have days that are Chol, and then Shabbos, and Yom Tov. Yom Kippur, as we could appreciate, is, as the Torah tells us, Shabbat Shabbaton. It is to a certain extent, it is above and beyond the rest. The holiest place in the world, without a doubt, Eretz Yisrael, the Mishnah tells us, has more Kedusha than all other lands. And in Eretz Yisrael, you have Yerushalayim, which has more Kedusha than the rest of the land. And then we come to Har Bayis, and the Makom HaMikdash, and the Heichal, and the Kodesh Kedoshim is ground zero for Kedusha. That's really where it all happens. And now you have, at this moment, inside the Kodesh Kedoshim, the Kohen Gadol, who is going to say the Shem HaMufurash, right? You have Hebrew, which is Lashon HaKodesh. Within the Hebrew language, we have certain words that are Kodesh, usually the names that are used to describe Hashem, the Shemus of Hashem. And then there is that Shem HaMufurash, that name that is only recited once by the Kohen Gadol in the Kodesh Kodashim on the holiest day of the year. And all of this is happening in complete and total privacy, which is a bit of a chiddush, because you would have thought, given how powerful a movement this is, given how impactful it is, and it is this moment which facilitates the kapara for all of Klal Yisrael, you would think that this is a moment that could and should be shared with as many people as possible. Obviously, in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, so there was no option yet for virtual hookups, and you couldn't do like Facebook Live like we're doing now. But if Mehiri Bar HaMikdash, in the time of the Bayis Shlishi, when the Kohen Gadol Be'ezras Hashem is going to enter the Kodesh Kodashim, we will have all the technology to allow for YouTube videos and live hookups and live feeds and Facebook Live. And you would think that we would try to share this moment with as many people as possible. And comes along the Torah and says, no. B'chol Adam, lo yiyah ba'olam moed, b'vo'o l'chaper v'kodesh. The Kohen Gadol is to be all by himself. Now before we try to explain this and rationalize it, especially in light of the fact that it seems inconsistent with the way we normally think and do things, let's just point out the obvious, and that is that this phenomenon is not unique to this particular example and situation. When you think about it, we also have Kedusha in our world today. What is the holiest object that we have in our possession today? A Sefer Torah. We have other objects that are considered to be Gufei, Dvarim Shebekdusha, we have Tefillin, Mezuzah, But without a doubt, the object that is considered to be holiest of all is the Sefer Torah. And you would think that we would take that Torah and we would display it in full view so everyone at all times, within reason, maybe we'd keep it in the shul to keep it safe, but everyone could see it. So when you would walk into shul, we would have a beautiful glass display and the Sefer Torah would be opened and everybody would be able to see it. What was that?
Some shuls do.
Some shuls do.
They don't use the Sefer Torah.
Right, but there's a reason why we don't do it, and there's a reason why most shuls don't. And that is because of the fact that the Sefer Torah is the holiest object. So what do we do with it? We store it away. We put it behind closed doors. When it's not in use, we don't touch it. In fact, even when it is in use, we try to avoid touching with our hands. The Gemara refers to the klaf of a Sefer Torah, that's uncovered, as being orum. Orum usually means unclothed, naked. A person without clothes is called orum. The Gemara uses that same expression to describe a Sefer Torah that is uncovered. And again, the question sort of begs itself, why is that? Why is it that something which is so holy has to be hidden? Perhaps we can gain some perspective into this, into thinking about, well, what was the most important moment in all of our history? What we'd say the most critical and defining moment in all of human history, but certainly Jewish history? Maimon Har Sinai, the moment of Matan Torah, the moment of divine revelation. And at that moment, after HaKadosh Baruch Hu introduces himself to the entire world, so Moshe ascends Har Sinai, as we know, for 40 days. And that initial attempt at a successful transmission of Torah to the Jewish people sort of fails because of the fact that Moshe descends, as we know, after 40 days. There's a Cheder Egel, and the first luchos are broken. Now, we usually imagine that moment and the failure of the Cheder Egel was something that was, you know, sort of on a certain level, it was a b'dieved, it wasn't supposed to be that way, it could have been avoided, it should have been avoided, and, you know, that's true on a certain level. However, Rav Soloveitchik pointed out that if you look at Rashi, you see that that's not necessarily so. Because the Torah says, source number 8, we read this on Tanis, that when Moshe ascended Har Sinai, so he was given very clear instructions. V'ish lo yale imach, v'gam isha yirov v'chol ahar gam atzon v'abakor al yiru amol ahorohu. That no one else is to ascend with the exception of Moshe Rabbeinu. Again, interesting, just as the Kohen Gadol goes into Kodesh Kodesh by himself, Moshe is to ascend Har Sinai by himself, nobody else is to be with him. Look what Rashi says over there. Harishonos, ayyadei shal yibetshuos v'kolos v'kohola, sholta ba'hen ayin ra'a, ein lucha mida yafa minatznius. Rashi says the first luchos, since they were given with much fanfare and excitement and noise and loud and with a major assemblage of people, sholta behen ayin hara, whatever that means, in this context, ayin hara will have to suffice, but there was some effect of what we call the evil eye. The entire moment had sort of been, to a certain extent, it had been ruined, spoiled by the fact that it had been in public, and Ein Lucham Idu Yafam Enatznias, says Rashi, at the end of the day, nothing is more precious, especially at such a moment, than Tznias itself. And the way the Rav explained what Rashi was saying is that the first luchos were essentially doomed from the start. So it's true that there is a story, and the story tells us that Klal Yisrael that had Bechira Chavshus at the time made certain choices which led to a certain outcome. But it almost seems as if Rashi was saying, the first luchos were doomed to destruction. That outcome was inevitable. They could never have lasted because of the fact that they had been subject to the Ayin Hara, which, of course was going to happen. Why? Because it happened with Chuos Vakolos. It happened with much fanfare and excitement. Now, what's really interesting and even paradoxical about this idea is that we know that moment of divine revelation in that very public way, with all that fanfare, excitement, we know that was necessary. Had it not been for that moment of divine revelation in front of so many people, I think it's fair to say that we would not be here today. You know, the engine that has essentially carried Torah through all of these generations, and the reason why we are still here, not just observing, but cherishing that very same Torah, is because there was that moment of national revelation, and so therefore our faith is so deep, it is so profound, and it has carried us, a relatively small people, through a very, very difficult and tumultuous history. So the moment of divine revelation was essential for our survival as a people, but it came at a cost. And the cost was because of the fact that it was public, because of the fact that so many people were watching and participating in that event, on a certain level, it was spoiled. Interestingly, it's not here on the sheets, but Rav Schechter and Sefer Eretz HaTzvi points out something which is also, I think, a chiddush to many. We sometimes think that when we come together as a tzibur, that that is somehow the ideal. Because after all, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, it says that yishtadel, a person should try to daven b'tzibur. It's true, you could daven at home, but all things being equal, a person should try to daven with a minyan. Not so that I can hear Kadosh Kedusha Baruch Hu. It's true that at home I can't have Kadosh Kedusha Baruch Hu. There are certain things that require minyan. But even separate from that, the idea of tefillah b'tzibur is that we come together and we daven as a tzibur. But even that, on a certain level, said the Rav, even that is b'dieved. Because on if all things being equal, if there were not a greater keem of coming together as a tzibur, really, elcha yafim enatznius, as Rashi says over here, really we should really live sort of private lives, particularly when it comes to matters of kedusha, and not celebrate them together as a group. So the fact of the matter is, Maimon Har Sinai, in all of its glory and fanfare, was necessary, but it came at a cost. And the cost is that there needed to be a second set of luchos that would be delivered, and these luchos would be prepared and would be received and essentially brought down from Har Sinai in private. And interestingly, and of course not coincidentally, on what day did that happen? And it ended Har Sinai for the final time on the day of Yom Kippurim, which was not merely a day of recovery and resolution and a day of tahara and kapara, because of the fact that it was sort of the end of this very, very difficult and trying time, and it was a time of reconciliation between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Jewish people. But it was also a day in which the Torah, in its purest form, the object of greatest kedusha in the world, could be preserved because of the fact that it was hush hush, without a big to do. Now, this idea of sort of celebrating and appreciating and connecting with moments of kedusha in solitude, rather than in public, in private, rather than with a group of people. So there seems to be a special, perhaps, benefit or emphasis this time of year. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah teaches, Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, the Fil Ches, source number 10, Barosh Hashanah, Kol Bo'ei Olam Ovrim Lefanav Kivnei Maron. And the day of Rosh Hashanah, all the people of the world pass before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kivnei Maron. Now the Gemara asks, what does that mean, Kivnei Maron? And the Gemara gives three interpretations, which are really three examples, perhaps even metaphors, but all of them essentially leading to the same conclusion. And that is that on the day of Rosh Hashanah, every person passes before God by him or herself. So Kivnei Marana, for example, Rashi on the next page says, means just like when a shepherd is gathering his sheep, or the owner of the sheep is counting them. So what he does is he brings them into a secure enclosed area and opens up a little narrow Pesach so that each one can pass one at a time. But two can't pass two at the same time. It's not wide enough. So too, on Rosh Hashanah, we pass before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kivnei Marana, in single file. The second allusion, Kamalos Beis Maron, also says Rashi over here the same idea, a very narrow pathway, or is the way soldiers line up before they go out to war. The same thing as well, Kacha Yamanu Asam Yotzim Zerach HaZebet Seisim L'Muhammad. One at a time they would count them. And there's an allusion to this, probably several, but the most famous of all, in the Nisan Tokef that we say on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, Kivakaras Roa Edro, Mavir Sono Tacha Shivto, Kin Tavor, Tavir Vesispar Vesimnev, Vesifko, Nefsh Kochoi, Vesachtov, Kitzba, Lachobri Yosecha, Vesichto, Vesgizardinam. Why do we say that just as a shepherd counts and watches and takes stock of his sheep, Mavir Sono Tacha Shivto, and each sheep passes under his shevet, under his staff, Kain Tavir Vesispar Vesimnev, so to HaKadosh Baruch Hu considers and counts carefully each and every Baal Chai, each and every person. So there is this idea that specifically on the Yom HaDin, it is a time that we are counted as individuals. The Gemara goes on to say, I didn't quote it over here, nevertheless, the Gemara says in the name of Rav Yochanan, B'kula Niskarim B'skira Achas, which means There is some sort of collective judgment as well. But let's just focus on this idea that we all pass before God in sort of in single file. What does that mean? I mean, what does that mean to you? Like, how would you understand that on as much of a practical level as you can? What does that mean?
God is looking at you specifically for your own merits or for your own not merits.
Right. In other words, there is a tendency that perhaps some would have to think, well, I'm part of a family, part of a community, you know, and there's a broader context. And God, if you're going to judge me, so you can't just look at me as if I'm the only person on earth. You have to consider the broader context. And on a certain level, that is true. And maybe that's what the Gemara means. When the Gemara means when it says, "Kulin eskar miskir achas," HaKadosh Baruch Hu, obviously, the Dayan HaEmes is going to judge every person in the most true way, which means that one's context, one's upbringing, one's family, one's circumstances, so that's all going to be considered. But at the same time, we may also sometimes have a tendency that when we are looking to do tshuva, sometimes we look to maybe blame other people, maybe sometimes we look to share our guilt with others, maybe we look to outsource our problems and have other people deal with them. The Rav, very powerful quote over here from the Sefer HaLetshuvah, source number 14. So he says, he's pointing out that vidui is something that cannot be done ayidei shaliach. You know, we have the concept of shaliach tzibur, and there are many parts of davening that if a person needs to, and maybe even sometimes the chachila, we rely on the shaliach tzibur, not when it comes to vidui. Said the Rav, uba'od shevidui shel kapara efshel omer v'tzarech l'omer yachad ima shaliach tzibur. It's true that there are times that the vidui is said together with the shatz. We know that sometimes we say the vidui quietly, and then we have this collective vidui we say together. Even though that's true, hare yef sheklal la'aso shliach l'tahara. I cannot appoint a shliach for tahara, for purification. Tahara yichovas gavra, yef she l'tamei l'shloach shliach l'mikvah l'dval avura. I can't have a person go to the mikvah on my behalf. If I'm the one who's tamei, I have to go to the mikvah. I can't say, you know, can you please go to the mikvah for me? Yef she l'shloach shliach that when it comes to a person's the need for a person to sort of lift himself from the zuama, from the filth, from the tumah, from the impurity of his life, so that's something I need to do by myself. And maybe what Chazal are trying to direct us to appreciate over here is, in general, there seems to be a mila of tznius. There seems to be a mila of avoiding, when possible, big public moments of fanfare. But specifically as far as the tshuva process is concerned, it seems to be even more important that we sort of recognize our own responsibilities and our own challenges as individuals. I see challenges because, take a look, there's a pasuk in Mishlei, Holech b'yashro yirei Hashem. One who walks b'yashro yirei Hashem. A yirei Hashem, a God-fearing person, is somebody who walks b'yashro. Now, there seems to be something in that pasuk, in that phrase, that seems to be grammatically either incorrect or maybe a little awkward. How would perhaps you would have thought that we can phrase this pasuk? What would you say, Reb Meish? Holech. Holech b'yashar. Yeah. Holech yashar, yirei Hashem. A person who walks straight on the path, right? You know, again, when you're walking, looking for directions in Israel, you ask, they say, Yashar, Yashar. They don't say, Yashrocha. So what does it mean? Holech b'yashro, a person who walks b'yashro, sort of in his straight line, Yirei Hashem. So look how the Gra explains this pasuk. Ki kol adam tzarech leches b'darko hatzarech lo. Everybody has to walk on the path that is appropriate, that is necessary for him. Ki emidos b'nei adam shavim zelozeh. Because people have their own personalities, their own proclivities, their own desires, their own needs, their own strengths, their own weaknesses. Everybody's different. It's only natural, says the God, that there are certain people who are going to be more naturally succumb to certain averas than others. You know, we all have our own struggles, our own demons, and what you struggle with is not necessarily something I'm going to struggle with, because we're different. We all have our own personalities and our own spiritual and emotional and psychological makeup. You are going to find certain things that I struggle with to be much easier. V'lachein holech b'yashrael. Therefore, the pasuk says, walk b'yashrael. B'derech hayashu shalom. Even though other people think you're crazy, they don't know what you're doing. This, you don't need this. The pasuk says, a yirei Hashem is a person who's not looking over his shoulder to see, well, what's he doing? Right? And there's a tendency that people sometimes have, particularly younger people, in yeshiva, let's say, to imitate others, perhaps other people that they look up to, and it's certainly noble. If a person, let's say, looks up to his Rebbe, so if my Rebbe has a certain chumrah, it's a certain midas chasidus, a certain, you know, hanhaga that he has that is inspiring to me, so I'm going to want to emulate my Rebbe. I think there's a difference between emulating somebody and imitating somebody. Emulating, in a general sense, certainly when it comes to one's positive midos, that's a good thing. But to imitate somebody is not so simple, because perhaps the reason why this individual is doing this is because this is what's appropriate for him, this is what he needs, but that's not necessarily consistent with my own needs. Baal Yeshua writes this explicitly in source number 19 on the next page. He says that a person should act in a way which is matim, which is appropriate for him and his character and who he is at that particular time. And he gives a mashal, just like I wouldn't go ahead and try to put on somebody else's suit because it's either going to be too big or too small. Every once in a while you get lucky and you find somebody who's the same size, but generally speaking, we have our own physical dimensions, not to mention our own tastes, etc. So I can't just take somebody else's suit and put on me. So too, when it comes to my avodas Hashem, it has to be unique to me. So the idea, just not forgetting where we started, maybe, that the Kohen Gadol enters the Kodesh Kodashim all by himself, representing not just himself, and not just his family, and all the Kohanim, and all the Jewish people, but sort of representing every Jew and our own experience. I'll actually interrupt myself right now by saying I heard years ago, I never saw this inside anywhere, but somebody once told me that the Rav had such a beautiful idea that, you know, just like, if you think about the Beis HaMikdash, there were different sections, right? There was the Azara, and then there was the Heichal, and we call the Heichal the Kodesh, and then the Kodesh Kodashim. So different areas had different levels of restriction. So the Kodesh Kodashim, we just saw, was off limits to everybody except the Kohen Gadol one day a year. The Kodesh, the Heichal, so that was off limits to everyone except Kohanim, and even then, you know, it was highly regulated and controlled who could enter when. The Azara was open to more people. You had to be Tahar, but etc., etc. So the deeper inside you go, the more limited the access. The Rav apparently explains, it's a beautiful idea, the same is true when it comes to our personalities. When you think about it, every person, right, there's that famous song. I don't know where the words come from. It's not a pasuk. Bevavi Mishkan Evne. Where's that from? Is that from Rav Nachman? I don't know where those words come from. But I'm going to build a Mishkan inside of my heart. But just imagine for a moment, a person, said the Rav, also has certain areas, sections of his personality that are going to be shared with more people, and then other parts of my personality are going to share with fewer people. So the Azara, let's say, my Azara is an area that you all see my Azara. My Azara, you know, that's the part that I show basically anybody who's interested in what I have to say or think or see. So I'm showing you my Azar right now. My Kodesh, my Heichal, so that's, you know, that's not for everybody. You know, I like all of you, but, you know, so my wife and my children, so they'll see my Kodesh, but that's not really going to be something that's going to be open for full display. And then there's a Kodesh Kodesh. Kodesh Kodesh, the Holy of Holies, so that's a place that is so personal, that is so deep inside of me, that it's really off limits for everybody, with the exception of me. And unfortunately, I would say, even I don't venture inside of that Kodesh Kodesh as often as I should. At the very least, on the day of Yom Kippur, again, this is apparently what the Rav said, on the day of Yom Kippur, we try to enter that Holy of Holies. So this idea that the Kohen Gadol goes into the Kodesh Kodesh all by himself, we can really use that, perhaps even as a metaphor, to describe our own process, not just of tshuva, but of really, really trying to become sort of in touch with ourselves. There is a tendency when it comes to tshuva, I alluded to this earlier, to perhaps try to protect ourselves by running for cover and by saying, well, you can't blame me, I'm part of a group. And Revolve again in the Sefer HaLeshua in source number 20, just from a different source, but same Sefer says the same idea. Sometimes imagine a person does something wrong and they say, why'd you do this? So they'll say, stop, I did it. What do you mean, why'd you do it? What prompted you to do such a silly thing? Well, you know, other people do it. Yeah, but why did you do it? I don't know. What were you thinking? A lot of things that we do, you know, we just do because, yeah, this is what people do. But that's not acceptable, and particularly not on the Yom HaDin. On the Yom HaDin is the day that we are being judged, again, Kivnei Maron, each and every one of us as individuals, and we have to sort of see ourselves as being that, as opposed to just being connected to a larger group of people, a larger community. Interestingly, in the book Sanctity of the Synagogue, which was written and edited by Rabbi Lam, which sort of defended the practice of Mechitza, which was a hotly contested issue several decades ago. Today, it's not really discussed so much anymore. I mean, it's pretty much accepted that in the Orthodox community, an Orthodox shul is almost defined universally as a shul that has a Mechitza. And you don't really find this as much debate as there once was. It's true that in certain communities and shuls, they'll debate how high the Mechitza should be, and how transparent it should be, and whether side to side, front to back. Okay, so those are important discussions, but that there should be a Mechitza separation between men and women in shul, that's something that, for the most part, in our community, we take for granted. Now, here I'm going to ask you a question I think you're going to think you know the answer to. I'm going to ask you anyway. Why do we have a Mechitza in shul? What's the purpose of a Mechitza? What is it designed to accomplish? It's not a trick question.
Sanctification.
Okay, but how? What?
By separating
who?
Husbands and wives.
Separating men and women. Let's just say Begadol. Separating men and women. That's what I wanted to do. Separating men and women so that we can, as you said, so that we can create a space which is conducive to Kedusha. Kedusha in general, by the way, the whole concept of Kedusha, actually, right, how does the pasuk Kedoshim Tiyu, so we know that the way Rashi, famous Ramban over there, but Rashi explains, what do you mean Kedoshim Tiyu? That you should be Prushim. Prushim means to separate. So the whole idea of being separated, designated for some higher purpose, is very consistent with the concept of Mechitza. And in general, we know that certainly this is the Hashkafah of the Torah, and I think we see it in the world as well. There is pushback, but I think people, especially over the past couple of years, have sort of come to this conclusion that there are certain sensitivities that, and potentially some issues that we run into when there are no separations between the sexes, and when people's, you know, the way they say it today, when somebody's personal space has been violated. And so therefore the concept of Mechitza really is very consistent with the whole notion of Kedusha. Interestingly, Rabbi Lam quotes an idea, and others speak about this at greater length from the Rav, again, that the Rav explained that's not really, well, I don't say that's not really what it is, but that's not the only function of Mechitza. The Rav had a different way of sort of explaining the purpose of Mechitza conceptually, and something that, I'm not sure if this is what you were alluding to earlier, but it was actually a separation not so much of men and women, but interesting, separation of husbands and wives, or family. Why is that? So the Rav explained that in other religions, you have a concept of a family pew. A family comes together, let's say, to church, and everybody sits together and occupies the space. And if you were asking me, you know, if I were starting, you know, my own religion, I would say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, families that, what do you say? That pray together, stay together. Yeah, it makes sense. You know, families should just like, you know, they're going to sit together in the movies and they can sit together in a restaurant. So, alachas kama v'kama, they should sit together when they come to pray to God. In Judaism, says the Rav, as soon as you walk past that threshold of the door and you enter the shul and you're coming into shul, the first thing we do is split up families. We break it apart right at the center. Husband's there, wife's there, son's there, daughter's there, brother's there, sister's there. Why? Because when we're together, hopefully, with members of our family, we feel a certain sense of comfort. We feel a sense of belonging, of togetherness. We feel comfort, we feel supported. All important things. But the Rav said, again, perhaps somewhat counterintuitively, when you come into shul, we try to break that a little bit. And people should feel a certain degree of vulnerability. I should feel like I am almost, I don't have my support system. I don't have the people in my life that I depend on so much outside of here right now. Right now I'm trying to achieve something which is more transcendent. I'm trying to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm trying to feel my reliance and my dependency on Him. And if I'm leaning so comfortably on my wife or my husband or other members of my family, so then maybe I don't feel that same need to rely as much on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the idea of the Mechitza, explained the Rav, is not so much a separation between men and women in a general sense, but it's really, again, to just sort of break up the family. Now, if you wanted to ask a kasha on that, then maybe, you know, family members should, even same gender should separate in shul. We don't take it that far. I haven't heard of such an idea, such a chumrah, that we would say that fathers shouldn't sit in his son. I mean, when it comes to many interesting hashkafic ideas, you know, there's a certain model, and we don't take it to its logical and complete conclusion. That may be disruptive, you know, that would be even more disruptive. But the idea that I come to shul and I should sort of feel like a little bit alone in the world, and therefore feel a greater sense of dependency and connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's a very, very profound idea. Yeah.
So why mechitza? Why not just have, like, you have at a wedding? When one side,
right.
Why transparency? Well, why all those questions?
Right. So that, I guess that's where, let's not forget where we started, as you pointed out, and that is that there are other functions of mechitza as well. And I certainly don't want to deny the fact that the concept of creating an atmosphere which is conducive to kedusha, which also means that people should not, you know, have any interest or desire or temptation to start looking at other people around there. So, those reasons are still 100% applicable, but beyond that, I was like, a nafkamina would be, I don't know if this is necessarily true for other technical reasons, but, I mean, let's say people are davening at home, like they're not davening in shul. So, you know, we don't have mechitza at home. We're not going to talk right now about a beis avel, which is something in between. It's like a temporary almost shul. It's not really a shul, a temporary place of prayer in a home. Even there, probably don't need mechitza, but you still have some degree of separation. But if a person is davening at home, you know, husband and wife davening together, so based on this, even if it's not letter of law, so in the spirit of the law, it would still seem to be that this idea that when I'm standing, as it says over, Rabbi Lam says over here, prayer means communion with the master of the world, and therefore withdrawal from all and everything. During prayer, man must feel alone, removed, isolated. He must then regard the Creator as an only friend from whom alone he can hope for support and consolation. What a beautiful idea. And the Sefer Tefillos Yisharim, he also explains very beautifully the whole idea of taking three steps forward when we start Shemon Esrei, and then again three steps back, has great symbolic significance. But what it means on sort of one most simple Pasha level, so when I take three steps forward, I am sort of leaving this domain where I find myself right now, namely surrounded by other people, and I'm entering this new domain where I'm Omid Lefnei HaMelech, which is me and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Of course, there are people standing all around me, but in my mind, I should sort of be in the zone. When I finish Shemoneh Esrei, I take three steps back, and interesting, right before I take three steps back, one of the first things I said, Alokai Nitzor L'Shoni Meira. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please help me watch my mouth. And my interactions with other people should be appropriate, and I shouldn't talk Lashon Hara. Why is that the first thing I say? Because when I'm beginning Shemon Esrei, I'm almost sort of leaving my entire world behind. At this moment, I'm not interacting with other people. It's just me and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As I re-enter the world, so there's sort of this awareness that, well, now I'm going to be around people again. And so therefore, I ask for divine assistance that I should be able to conduct myself appropriately in this setting. So it's a very, very interesting idea. Like I said, something which has relevance not just on these days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but all throughout the year. As we approach the end of our shiur tonight, I want to just sort of take this even maybe sort of to the next level a little bit. That is, there's a Mishnah Pirkei Avos which says, fascinating Mishnah, Chanina ben Chachinoy Omer, Haneir v'lai v'amalach v'amahalich b'derech yichidi, v'mfana libel v'atala, hareze meschai v'nafsha. It's difficult to translate these words literally, but we'll try to do it anyway. If a person is awake at night, and is walking alone on the road, just taking a walk outside by himself, and he allows his heart to just sort of stray levatala. He's wasting his time doing nothing, thinking about nothing. Harezim eschai benafsho, which literally would mean like he's held accountable with his life. It doesn't quite mean eschai misa, but they're very strong words. It basically means that's almost like an unforgivable sin. Now what's the problem over here? What did I do wrong? He wasn't bothering anybody. He wasn't violating anybody. He wasn't trespassing anybody's property. He wasn't breaking anything. He wasn't talking like Shana. It was by himself. He was just, you know, playing a game on his phone. Like, why is that such a terrible thing? So the Rabbi Yonah explains over here, it's so terrible because these are sha'os ritsuyos. These are very special moments. And why would you waste? Why would you squander such a special moment where you're all by yourself? And you have to imagine, like the crickets in the background. Now, Cleo and I, actually, almost every day for the last couple of weeks, I've been trying to come to the earliest lichos in the morning. It's still very dark outside. In some ways, it's like the darkest time of the night. I've been walking to shul. It's very, very, very beautiful. It's just a very, very peaceful time. It's very quiet outside. And even though my walk to shul is not very long, it would be probably helpful if it was a few minutes longer. It really is just like, it's a great way to sort of get in that zone, because these are what Rav Yonah describes over here as sha'os ritsuyos. These are moments which were made for moments of reflection. If this person who has this opportunity, which is all by himself, and you would think, well, I'm all by myself, so there's no one to talk to, there's nothing to do, so just leave me alone. So here comes along the Mishnah Pirkei Avos and says, are you crazy? Those are the most special moments in life when you're all by yourself. Now, again, Chazal are not telling us that we should completely disassociate ourselves from everybody we know. We should run away from home, and we should, you know, cancel, we should delete all the contacts from our phone, and with the exception of 911, that's it. I have no contacts with the outside world. Of course not. That's absurd, and that, on so many levels, is completely inconsistent with Torah thinking and Torah values and what it means to be a person, you know, a person who is living a full life as a Torah Jew. That being said, there are moments which we will stumble upon, and then there are moments in life which we need to seize, and which we are appreciating and cherishing what can be accomplished, especially and maybe even only when we are alone. There's a beautiful essay which over the years I've referred to several times. There's an excerpt over here, a rather long one, called The End of Solitude. But the point being made, and this was written probably at the beginning of the world in which we find ourselves right now, you know, so when the internet first became popular in the, I guess, the mid-90s, late 90s, so that's probably when this article was written. And he talks about how certain sociological changes have a great impact upon that generation. So he says how television, you know, created boredom. That before television, nobody was bored. Why weren't people bored? Because there was always something to do.
Interacted.
Yeah, we just interacted with the world and with nature and with each other. And then when a generation is raised on television, so then when there's nothing on TV, people don't know what to do themselves, so they feel bored. So he says that our generation we've already been, you know, conditioned to boredom. So with the current generation, it's not boredom which is the problem, but it is being alone, a sense of loneliness. Because the internet, he says, is a powerful machine for the production of loneliness as television is for the manufacture of boredom. If 6 hours of television a day creates the aptitude for boredom, the inability to sit still, 100 text messages a day creates the aptitude for loneliness, the inability to sit, to be by yourself. It's funny, he refers to 100 text messages a day. You can see how old this is.
Yeah.
You remember those days? Wow. Days when a person only got 100 texts a day. The good old days. But now we're talking about hundreds of texts an hour. Literally. Let's be honest. I mean, you know, it's just unbelievable. They just come in so, again, text messages, emails, WhatsApps, whatever you want to call them, but we're constantly being zapped and pinged and dinged from the outside hundreds of times an hour, maybe thousands of times an hour. So, on the one hand, and it's one of the great, you know, it's such a paradox of the world in which we live, we are so connected, but we are so connected and yet so disconnected, not only from other people, but especially from ourselves. Because where there used to be moments in a person's life when they would really be alone and they would have nothing to do and really claim those moments and cherish them as the Mishnah Pirkei Avos says we need to do, now, even when a person is alone, or they're not alone. The Ali Shore, again, is getting a lot of press tonight. He writes about the importance of what's called bedidos, or hisbodidos, moments of just being alone. And he talks about, he gives a very fascinating analogy over here. I love this. I love this. He says that when you look up at the sky during the day, you don't see any stars. You don't see, usually won't see the moon either. Sometimes you can see the moon during the day, certain hours, certain times of the month. But you certainly don't see any stars. And then, as it gets dark outside, suddenly stars begin to appear. Over here, because there's so much light pollution, even here we're pretty limited to how many stars we can see. But if you go farther from the city, into areas in which there is, you know, there are fewer people living, fewer lights, so then the entire sky opens up, and you can suddenly see thousands, millions of stars. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. Now, the point he makes, which of course we know, is that the stars are always there. It's not that the stars come out at night. We call it Seis HaKochavim. The stars coming out, but the stars aren't coming out. The stars are always there. Elamai, as long as it's light, we can't see them. But when it gets dark, so then suddenly we can discover them. And he says that that's the same. It's the same thing with our souls. That during the day, we don't mean literally the day, but during the busy hours when we are interacting with other people and we are socializing and just busy, so it's hard to really appreciate and to see and to sense, you know, what's going inside of our souls. But then you have moments where it just gets quieter. You have moments in which we withdraw, we pull back, and we're not in touch with as many people those moments. And it's moments like that that we can really see the stars inside of our soul. We can appreciate the worlds that exist. They're always there, but it's hard for us to appreciate them, and it's hard for us to connect with them. These are very, very important moments in a person's life, especially for a person to be able to develop, cultivate, and nurture, and preserve one's spiritual identity. This is such an important part of what it means to be a Jew. You know, there are so many parts of our observance which are related to actions. We are, at the end of the day, we are focused very often on specific actions and behaviors and things that we need to do. Virtually every time we recite a Birchus HaMitzvah, with very few exceptions, we're doing something or saying something and saying, okay, here's the bracha, and here's now what I'm going to do. But at the same time, all mitzvahs on a certain level, and some mitzvahs very clearly are really designed not so much to get us to do things, but to get us to think a certain way and get us to be a certain way. And by definition, these are moments in life which require us to sort of pull back and sort of withdraw and to reflect. And so I think, you know, I'll stop at the Mamar Komos now, even though there's more that I didn't get to. But just to conclude by making the point that let's end by how we started. The day of Yom Kippurim was a very special day for many reasons. But one of the things that happened in Yom Kippur was that the Kohen Gadol will enter the Kodesh Kodashim all by himself. And he'll be there all by himself. And as we saw, that it's not just that there's an issur for other people to be there, but in order for the ultimate goal, for the purpose of Yom Kippur to be fulfilled, so the Kohen has to be by himself. Because there are certain moments in life which can only be properly executed and fulfilled and appreciated when a person is by himself. And we pointed out why, when it comes to tshuva in particular, this is such an important component of tshuva, because tshuva by definition is personal. What I need to do in order to improve myself is something which is unique to me. And if I'm just going to constantly see myself as being part of a group, dependent, and somehow, you know, constantly relying on other people around me, I may abdicate, you know, my responsibility, my role to see myself as being a singular person. Person has to always remember that a person was created, the Mishnah and others, it's on the sheets, but we didn't see it, that a person, Mishnah tells us, that a chayv adam lomar b'shvila nivra olam, and the reason why Adam Rishon was created as a singular individual, as opposed to God creating an entire population at once, is so we should always remember that each and every individual is an olam male, I'm my own person. And if tshuva is partially, primarily about sort of coming to terms with who I am, looking for ways to address and to correct and to fix the imperfections of my life and try to look for ways to improve, by definition, that is a process which requires moments of introspection and solitude, moments in which I find myself alone. This was always important. It's always been important, but it's especially important in the world in which we live today, a world which is unfortunately filled with lots of noise, lots of pollution, noise pollution, light pollution, digital pollution, pollution which completely, you know, clouds our ability to see and to appreciate and to even find these moments. So let us hope and pray that the day of Yom Kippur, a day which is designed to enable us to find our way into our personal Holy of Holies, will inspire us to remember that this should be a value not only one day a year, but all throughout the year, even when we are with other people, but especially at moments that where you're by yourself, to appreciate how much can you accomplish when a person is really able to appreciate moments of his bodhidus, moments all by himself. Thank you very much. I look forward to learning with you again soon. Thank you.
The word Kippurim has the word.